Do-do-do-do-do-do. Oh, man, time to record the podcast. I wonder where John and Laurel are. Oh, here comes John. Hey, John.
Oh, hey, Sean. How's it going?
Oh, my gosh, buddy. You're carrying so much stuff. What do you got there?
Oh, nothing. Just some holiday stuff. Got some presents and a Yule log and some eggnog and some cookie tins and some jingle bells.
You want me to give you a hand with that?
No, I'm good. I'm just going to put it down.
Oh, man. What a mess.
Oh, man, this holiday hustle and bustle.
I hear you, buddy. Don't worry about that. We'll clean it up later. Now, where is Laurel? Oh, here she comes. Hey, Laurel.
Hey, guys. There was a sugar cookie rolling down the hallway. Was
yeah.
it from here?
Yeah,
don't worry
sorry,
about
you
know, it.
Classic holiday hustle and bustle. But what do you got there? You're carrying so much stuff.
Oh, yeah. So I have got all the news that happened this week. I've got a report. I've got a new medical marijuana bill and some new poll numbers.
Yeah. Do you want me to give you a hand with that?
Oh, no. It's good. I'm just going to...
Oh, man. Look at all this stuff. I gotta say, guys, one of these piles looks more like a podcast than the other.
Yule logs?
No, it's the other pile.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
This is the WPR Politics Podcast. I'm Sean Johnson.
I'm John K. Wilson.
And I'm Laurel White.
This week, the hustle and bustle of holiday news.
Well, happy holidays, guys.
Happy holidays, John. Happy holidays, Laurel.
You guys ready to start digging through this pile of holiday news?
Yeah, I sure am.
Where are we going to go first?
Well, we have a new bill introduced by Republican lawmakers to legalize medical marijuana in Wisconsin.
This is a really big deal.
I thought it's not a big deal because we've had so many efforts to bring medical marijuana to Wisconsin in the past.
I think it's a big deal because of who is introducing it. It is a Republican bill. This has been a cause that has by and large been championed in Wisconsin by Democrats. And here you have a group of Republicans coming out and saying, we got to catch up with all these other states that are offering people medical marijuana. And they even drafted it with Republicans in mind. I mean, they are mm-hmm. looking around at other states and seeing, okay, what have other states passed? What have states with Republican majorities passed? And they modeled their bill that way. They're being kind of transparent about like the political angle of this.
So who are the lawmakers that are behind this?
The two main sponsors of this bill are State Representative Mary Felskowski and State Senator Kathy Bernier. So Mary Felskowski is who talked to us for this. And I mean, she has a personal story here. She is a cancer survivor. She has, dealt with cancer using legal medication, which has a lot of side effects, right? Mm-hmm. And we talk all the time and people talk all the time in the Capitol building about the downsides of opioids. And she's saying, here's an opportunity to do something different, something natural. And to hear Mary Felskowski talk about this, she's saying, look, if this is a natural substance that I am putting in my body and it's not hurting anybody else, I don't think there should be a problem with that. And this is a conservative Republican lawmaker who is making this case. This bill is different from one of the bipartisan bills that's out there for medical marijuana in that there are more restrictions. For example, under the Republican medical marijuana bill, you would not be allowed to smoke marijuana. It could not be in gummy form. Again, they are looking at getting Republican votes for this in a state where the Republicans run the legislature. You couldn't grow it yourself. It's just more regulated.
Mm-hmm. So does that mean it looks like it has a better chance of going anywhere?
No, I mean,
ask leadingly.
You know the answer to this question. In fact, Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald put out a very brief statement after it was introduced saying, I don't support it, and I don't think there are enough Republican votes. There are not. He said that I don't think there are enough votes in our caucus to pass this. And then Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, who has been more open to medical marijuana, also said, I don't think there are enough votes in our caucus to pass this. So I just want to just focus in on that a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, practically speaking, they're saying it's not going to pass. But if you dig into what they're saying there a little bit more, if this, you know, they're saying there aren't enough Republican votes to pass this. Mm-hmm. If it were to come to the floor for a straight up or down vote, the fact that you have now Republicans on the record in support of this stuff, and you know there are Democrats in support of this stuff, this is one of those where if it had an up or down vote on the floor, it would probably pass, mm-hmm. is what I'm hearing when they say this kind of stuff. Like, there's not enough Republican votes, but you know, if we just put it for a vote, it might pass. So that's probably not going to happen. That's just not the way that the legislature operates. If Republicans can't get it out of caucus, they're not going to bring it to the floor for a vote. If there's a polling motion to try to force a vote, they're not going to allow that in all likelihood. But I think it's symbolically significant that they're out there introducing this. They're hoping for a public hearing. I don't know if that's a given by any means, but symbolically significant. This is not the first time, though, guys, that a Republican lawmaker has introduced this. I was just looking back in our archives, and mm-hmm. back in like mm-hmm. 2005, Greg Underheim, he was a Republican state lawmaker, introduced a medical marijuana bill. Greg Underheim was also a cancer survivor. So it's just one of those things where I'm not saying that's like the only reason Mary Falzkowski introduced this, but man, cancer really changes people's perspective on everything.
It's a factor. And I think we should mention that the bipartisan bill that you briefly mentioned before has a Republican co-sponsor, the one that was floating around the Capitol before.
Patrick Testin, right?
Yeah.
And he's in a swing district. Mm-hmm. So that gives you a hint at where the public is headed on this issue. The fact that the Republican lawmaker in the most competitive district possibly is out there with Democrats on this bill.
Mm-hmm. All right. Next topic.
Next topic.
What else we got in this pile here?
Well, I don't know. I think maybe we need to make a sharp departure from our jovial introduction and talk about a very serious piece of news that mm-hmm. Laurel White covered this week.
Yeah. So we got a report that we've been waiting for a really long time from the Federal National Guard. This was a 6-month long investigation into how the Wisconsin National Guard has been handling sexual assault and sexual harassment.
I feel like we need some background here. Can you kind of talk us through how this began and how this story has developed over the past 6 months?
Yeah. So this all started earlier this year in March when the governor and Senator Baldwin requested the Federal National Guard conduct this investigation. They had both been contacted by whistleblowers saying that things weren't going as they should within the Wisconsin National Guard in terms of punishing people who had committed sexual assault or sexual harassment. These individuals, these whistleblowers, said that they had either witnessed or been personally involved in cases that they didn't think had been handled appropriately. There was also a whistleblower that contacted Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald's office. So that's kind of what spurred this investigation about 6 months ago or so.
And what's kind of the big takeaway from the report? You know, if there's one thing that stood out, I mean, there was one thing that stood out to me reading about it. Mm-hmm. What'd you think?
I think the biggest thing that came out of this report was the fact that the Wisconsin National Guard has been violating federal law and federal regulations for how these investigations of sexual assault and how the procedures for sexual assault are supposed to play out within the Guard. So it's a pretty, obviously pretty big departure from the way that things are supposed to go.
So instead of going to the feds with this, they're doing internal investigations of themselves, right?
Yeah. So that's the regulation part. That's how they're violating these agency rules. So the Department of Defense, the Department of the Air Force, these organizations have specific ways that that military bodies are supposed to handle sexual assault and sexual harassment allegations. And one of those things that they're supposed to do is refer the allegations to an outside party. So investigations can happen through like local law enforcement, for example. But the Wisconsin National Guard was doing all of their investigations in-house. So that really violated that regulation.
So the report came out on Monday, and then there was some news that broke following the release of the report, right?
Mm-hmm. So the big news, other than the report and kind of spurred by the report, is the resignation of Major General Donald Dunbar, who's the, and I always have a hard time with this, adjutant Adjutant. Yeah. See, I can't. There's a disconnect in my brain for saying that. But he's the head, essentially, of the Wisconsin National Guard.
You just cough when you say that word.
Yeah. Yeah. I just say Major General Donald Dunbar, the head of the National Guard. And that works. The way to get around.
We
it
all
for
have
me,
those but, workarounds for certain words.
Yeah. But he, the governor's office announced that they had asked for his resignation and that he had given it on Monday in the wake of this report.
And he has been around for a long time. Mm-hmm. This is not somebody that Tony Evers appointed. It's not somebody that Scott Walker appointed. This is somebody who goes back to the administration of former Democratic Governor Jim Doyle. Mm-hmm. So he has been kind of a mainstay in Wisconsin and will be no longer.
Yeah. I mean, he's the person that's obviously since that time, I think it was 2007.
Right.
That Governor Doyle appointed him. So he's overseen, you know, all of the deployments of Wisconsin National Guard service people. You know, he's handled the response to natural disasters.
Yeah.
In the state since that time. So obviously a really big, important figure in Wisconsin, and he's not going to be around anymore because the governor said there needs to be a top-to-bottom reorganization of the National Guard because of these, in his opinion, like systemic problems with how they're handling sexual assault and harassment.
So the report sort of pointed out all of these shortcomings in the process that had been going on, but then didn't it come up with a bunch of sort of recommendations to correct it as well?
Yeah, so they had more than 20 recommendations for how to fix this process. Obviously, you know, the big one we talked about a little bit, the fact that they've just been doing these internal investigations and not referring them to an outside entity, that's something that needs to change. The way that the Wisconsin National Guard was actually in violation of federal law is that they weren't reporting statistics about these assaults or allegations of assault to a federal database that Congress said needed to be maintained to help track these things within National Guard outfits across the country. So that's something that's going to have to be changed. It was such a broad report as to, you know, kind of the problems within this. So it was record keeping was an issue. It was how investigations were handled. It was the level of staffing, the number of people that could do these investigations and how well they were trained. So the recommendations, the more than 20 recommendations, span all of those things to sort of completely reorganize how the department handles all of this stuff going forward.
One thing that I've been kind of wondering as this story has unfolded is where does it fit into the usual political arguments that we have around here, you know?
I was going to ask the same question.
Oh, good. We are like minds, you know? Well, Laurel, answer this pressing question. We obviously both want to know.
From two-thirds of the pod.
Like, on most things, I know where Democrats are going to be arguing and Republicans are going to be arguing or when they'll be at odds, and I'm not sure on this one.
Well, this is something, you know, I mentioned, obviously, that, you know, Governor Evers and Senator Baldwin were the ones that requested this investigation, but Senator Fitzgerald, a Republican, had gotten a similar whistleblower alert. He had also called for the National Guard to look into how they were doing things, but got a little bit of pushback to his particular request. I guess the bottom line here is there seems to be more bipartisan agreement about addressing this problem and making these changes. And you know, from the very beginning of, you know, looking into this to now of actually how these things are going to be implemented. So I think it's kind of an example of Republicans and Democrats being a little bit more on the same page than we're used to seeing them.
Wow. You do not see that very often.
All right. Next topic.
Next topic.
Do we have one more thing to pull out of this pile here?
Yeah, we do. Let's see. We got the Yule log here. No, we're not talking.
John's pile has mingled with my pile.
I don't even know what a Yule log is.
It's a log.
It's got a dessert.
Some candles.
It's a form of dessert with candles in it.
No, what? It's not a dessert.
A Yule log is not a.
It's
food?
A straight.
I
up...
thought a Yule log was like a Swiss roll.
Oh, we reached the part of the podcast where Laurel brings something up that is funny. Last week it was Turner and Hooch. This week it is misunderstanding about Yule log.
Seriously, a Yule log is not edible?
It's a log. It's a straight up log.
I don't believe you. I'm Googling this right now.
Cue elevator music. Okay, let's resume the podcast. We have a little argument here. So Laurel Googled Yule log.
And the first things that came up were recipes for Yule logs because it's baked good.
Okay, but what if we go to the Yule log entry in Wikipedia, which is never wrong about anything. The Yule log, Yule clog, or Christmas block is a specially selected log burnt on a hearth as a Christmas tradition in a number of countries in Europe. The origin of the folk custom is unclear, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a straight up log.
There has to be, mention.
The actual log came first, and then people are like, this log is so great. What if we created a cake that mimics the log that we don't burn, but we eat it?
How is it possible that this Wikipedia page doesn't even mention the treat?
Because it is less prominent than an actual Yule log. Have you ever turned on, like, you know, there's a TV station that just plays a logs burning? That's just a fireplace.
All right. I'm going to take my hostly prerogative here and get us back on track.
Okay.
What's the third newsy thing we're going to talk about?
I'm sorry. We had another Marquette poll this week, and I mean, we're putting this third because, one, I feel like we're talking about polls a lot again, and we sort of have told ourselves, don't talk about polls so much, and here we are talking about polls every time they come out, you know.
It's our favorite.
Are you shaking your head at like the Yule log argument?
I'm trying to shake off the Yule log thing. I just had to set my phone away. It's all right. I can be distracted by poll numbers.
All right.
It's fine.
You know,
it's the gift for any time of year, the Marquette poll.
I guess, and the thing about this Marquette poll specifically is that it didn't really budge much compared to the last one that we talked about back in November. This is basically not entirely, but almost identical when it comes to key questions like, should President Trump be impeached and removed from office?
Which on its face does not sound very exciting. Like, poll numbers have not changed. But I think that was remarkable for people because so much has happened in the impeachment proceedings since the last poll. Like, we've had all of these very public, very lengthy, very dramatic hearings about the impeachment. And the takeaway is they're not changing people's minds at all, at least in Wisconsin, of the people that have been surveyed by Marquette.
Yeah, when they're asked, should the president be impeached and removed, it was like 40% said yes, 52% said no. Last month, it was 40 to 53. And in the partisan divide here is what really struck me on this issue. Not that it is partisan, and that you have Republicans in favor and Democrats opposed, but when it comes to this issue, Republicans are more sure of where they're at on it than Democrats are. So 94% of Republicans in this poll said, no, he should not be impeached and removed from office. 94%. Among Democrats, should he be impeached and removed? It's like 80%. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if you got five Democrats in a room, there'd be one Democrat who'd be like, no, I don't think he should be impeached and removed. In Madison, Wisconsin, you know, it's maybe hard to imagine that conversation, but statistically, there it is. One in five Democrats would not be so sure about impeachment, and that's the base.
I wonder if, and this is something that we can't really get from the poll numbers, but I wonder how many of the Democrats that oppose impeachment oppose it because of the substance of what the allegations against the president are, what the evidence against the president is, versus kind of the political implications of impeachment. Like whether they think that impeaching the president is a bad look for Democrats or potentially bad for the 2020 election for Democrats, just kind of a bridge too far. We've heard people talk about that, how it could kind of backfire for Democrats. So I wonder if some Democrats oppose impeachment just because of that versus kind of the arguments themselves.
I mean, that is definitely one theory that's been thrown out there, is that even if Democrats are nearly united in their dislike of the president, they have mixed feelings Let's say some of them do when it comes to what to do about that. Mm-hmm. There was also more polling on who should Democrats nominate. I mean, the poll asked Democratic primary voters who they favor.
That's what I was going to ask about.
Good. We're just on the same wavelength here yet again. Here, have a cookie, buddy.
Thanks. I'm going to eat this Yule log, which is just a real log. That is
a log.
I can go back to this argument. I shouldn't.
All right.
Just Google Yule log. What comes up first? That's all I'm going to say.
You know, on Easter, if you have like a lamb cake or something, it's not an actual, that's not an actual lamb, but it is based on an actual lamb.
Wait, people make lamb cakes on Easter?
With the icing that you, with like the little blossom icing.
Yeah, they look like a lamb. And then you slice it apart just like you do.
Weird.
Which is kind of disturbing when you think about it. Actually, very disturbing.
A little bit.
But you make a lot of cakes to look like a lot of things, especially for kids' birthday parties, and then cut them apart and eat them.
Much like we are slicing and dicing these poll results.
Mm. Oh, look at you bringing it back.
So what did likely Democratic primary voters say about who their first choice was in the Democratic primary for president? First choice, Joe Biden, 23%. Second choice, Bernie Sanders, 19%. Third choice, Elizabeth Warren, 16%. Fourth place, Pete
Buttigieg.
Pete Buttigieg. It's not that hard, really. But you
no,
just,
but you
I don't
get
have that,
that
muscle memory yet from saying it over and over. Pete Buttigieg is in fourth place pretty firmly at 15%. And then you go down to Cory Booker at 4% and some more names. I could go on.
But there were also there were head-to-heads, too, where we did see a little bit of movement.
A little bit. Last month, remember, the Democrats all trailed President Trump in head-to-head matchups. This month, Joe Biden was ahead of Trump.
By one point.
Like a point.
Can we have a little aside here? And, you know, host prerogative, maybe John will cut this later. But can we talk about, and we've probably done this on the podcast before, but just humor me. Can we talk about margins of error again?
Sure can.
So this is a plus or minus 4.1% margin of error, I think.
For the whole sample. Now you get into Democratic primary voters, that is a smaller sample. So that sample size is 358 and the margin of error is plus or minus 6.3 percentage points.
Okay, so when we're talking about head-to-head matchups between like, for example, President Trump and Joe Biden. Is that with the full sample or is that with the smaller sample?
That is with the smaller sample. Okay, so the margin of error is pretty large.
So that's a plus or minus 6.2,
I think 6. I just said, right?
6.2.
Yeah.
So
what that means is...
Talk me through that. Does that mean that can be a 12, like it can be, one can be 6 points higher and the other can be 6 points lower?
Yeah. I'm not sure, just to shout out to pollsters, and I know you are legion. I'm not sure why like political science decided to do margin of error this way. Maybe this is just like a statistics thing. And like, look, journalist, go back into your your sandbox here. We'll take care of the big questions. But it is so confusing to people because really it's 12 is the way I think about it. It's 12.4 because it means Joe Biden could be 6.2% higher and Donald Trump could be 6.2% lower or vice versa. Uh-huh. Like there's a pretty wide range of what the numbers could be based upon the way that we describe margin of error. And yeah, these results are definitely within it.
Yeah.
When it comes to the head-to-head.
So if you have a 6.2 margin of error, essentially to be outside of the margin of error, you would have to have a lead of more than 12 points. Is that right?
I think so. So let's talk about it with the impeachment numbers. It's 52% oppose, 40% support. That's 12%, but that's with the full sample. The full sample margin of error was roughly 4%. So that is outside of the margin of error. That's saying like even if we're wrong here, we're confident that this is outside of the margin of error. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah,
for sure. I just feel like these numbers are so important in some ways because we point to them and say, like, these candidates are really, really close.
I know. Like last month,
they're not
Biden's
really
down.
Close.
Now he's up. He must be doing something. Like,
but that's
nah, I mean,
but it's
just
a change
like,
of like 2%.
It's probably just noise. Know, like, it's like you to say to draw some conclusion from it is probably dubious.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad we're here to sort that all out. And get his.
Yeah.
If you have made it this far in the podcast, you've realized we have no idea what we're talking about.
Come on. I think we did okay.
We know some things.
And if we edit this later and find out that we were wrong, you'll never hear this part anyway.
Yep. Well, Sean Johnson is WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief.
Laurel White is WPR's Capitol Reporter.
And John K. Wilson is our resident politics nerd.
Okay, guys, time to pick up this mess.
Ooh, I'm gonna get cookie.
Are you feeling overwhelmed by the holiday hustle and bustle? Not sure which podcasts to get your friends and family? Well, make it easy on yourself and just subscribe everybody to the WPR Politics Podcast on Apple Podcasts. You can also find it on Google Play and Stitcher, as well as many other podcast apps. And you can catch up on all of our past episodes anytime at wpr.org/politics.